Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. And podcasts of prior shows are available at each of those websites as well. Today is February 24th, 2016. The markets were up today, the Dow closing at 16,484, the NASDAQ at 4542, and the S&P at 1929. We are talking about estate administration when dealing with personal property and items of value we leave behind when we die. If you're an executor or trustee, what do you have to know? Last week, we discussed I don't know what we discussed last week. I don't even remember now. But we are live tonight, so we will take your questions. Judy Ann is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you could still ask questions off topic and I'll do my best to answer. The number is 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. Tonight we're talking about estate administration issues when dealing with personal property. This would apply to anyone with personal possessions, so that's most of us. But to talk more on that tonight is my guest and friend, attorney Eric Strauss of Wirth, McGee & Fisher. Eric focuses his practice on estate planning, estate administration, and orphans court litigation. Eric's a member of the Lehigh and Carbon County Bar Associations, as well as the Pennsylvania Bar Association and Lehigh Valley Estate Planning Council. He's authored numerous articles and frequently lectures to community and professional groups, including the National Business Institute and Pennsylvania Bar Institute, on the topics of estate planning, estate administration, trust administration, fiduciary income tax, Pennsylvania inheritance tax, federal estate tax, and related areas. Eric is also very involved in community organizations. And in fact, I met Eric teaching, and I was very impressed, and we've been pretty much friends ever since, I'd say, many, many years ago. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thanks, Lori. Great to be here on this beautiful, rainy evening in Bethlehem.
Yeah, well, hopefully people are in their cars longer. They have nothing better to do than to listen to us, but it's going to be all great information tonight. And Eric likes educating people as well as I do, so hopefully we'll be able to do that tonight. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number again, 610-758-8810. So do you mind if we just start right into it, Eric?
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's start talking about what makes someone's estate. You know, I think it's important for people to kind of understand what is an estate, give them kind of an overview of that, and then let's talk about personal property and why that can add little glitches in estate administration, which we'll talk about for the rest of the show.
This is a great topic, Lori, because we all have stuff. And when we talk about estate law, the technical term you would hear is tangible personal property. Okay, so a person dies, they have an estate. An estate is anything that's titled in their name that is not designated either by contract, such as an IRA that might pass by beneficiary designation, or some people have accounts that are jointly titled that pass by right of survivorship. So a person's estate is everything else, typically a house, cash, investments that are just individually titled, and again, tangible personal property, which is funny because I meet with clients in estate planning contexts, and I deal with executors and administrators in the context of estate administrations. And folks tend to immediately focus on their investments and their cash and their real estate, and often don't really think about all the stuff they own. And sometimes that stuff has value, and there are a lot of issues that surround both lifetime planning for those assets and how you would dispose of them within an estate. And it's odd. I sit with clients all the time, and they tell me, again, about their investments and so forth. And sometimes they have their CD-ROM or their Excel spreadsheets, and I say, well, what about your stuff? And they sort of look at me. And I think sometimes it's selective ignorance. Sometimes they just don't think of their things, even very valuable items, paintings, artwork, sculptures, gun collections, coin collections. They don't think of those things as assets with value. Mm-hmm. And that comes at great risk.
Mm-hmm. Or they think it's just going to kind of the kids are going to come in and take it out. But that's not exactly how it should work. So you mentioned, you know, some lifetime planning, and this is part of what you hope clients do when they come in to meet with you to talk about administration, about doing the planning. So what can someone today do to help their executor, or, you know, if you are an executor, you need to keep this in mind for the people that you're saying you're going to be the executive for? You want to make sure that they have their stuff in order for you. So what can people do during their lifetime to make that an easier process for the people that they're passing those assets to or for the executor?
Great question. And you know, with the assumption that all of our listeners are alive, there are steps that we can take when we're alive to make our executor's job easier. And when, you know, really we're talking, you know, look, most people in a household, you have a lot of things that are of very little value. You know, your furniture, things like that. I mean, you can go to a yard sale and get a sofa for $5. but when it comes to items that are truly collectible and have value, the collector can add a lot of value to their collection by how they document it. And I'm talking about a concept that collectors refer to as provenance. So if I find an old sword in my attic, it may have value. But if I have documentation that it was my great-great-great-grandfather's, and I have a picture of him in the Civil War with that horse, and I have his discharge papers, and I have a tracing that, you know, he gave it to his son who gave it to his son, and that it's passed through each generation, hopefully listed on a tax return at each passing, that adds value to the piece. Because anyone who, if I go to auction that piece or sell it at a gallery or to another collector, they're very interested in the provenance. And that's information that's often lost. You know, children who do not share a collector's passion for their collection, or a spouse that doesn't share a collector's passion for their collection, they may know, oh yeah, that old sword's in the attic, but they may not know the history. And all the paperwork and so forth might get thrown into a dumpster, and that really can result in a huge loss in value. You know, I have clients who collect toys. So if I have 100 antique toy cars on a shelf, my kids have probably seen that. And when I die, maybe they'll say, well, you know, we got to do something with those cars. They may not know that I have all the original boxes up in the attic, or they may not realize that the piece is a lot more valuable if it's in the box. Mm-hmm. So documenting what you have, the history, it's a good idea to photograph items with detailed photographs, and preserve records of what you paid for a particular piece, or if it was inherited from another family member or a loved one, you want to save records of how you acquired title. That's all very important to anyone you would ultimately sell it to.
You know, it's funny. I think people watch those TV shows. What's the point? There's
Antiques Roadshow. I cringe.
All kinds of programs like that, you know, kind of can demonstrate that either maybe it's not as much value that you thought it was, but quite often there's items that are of value that people had no idea it was. So we're going to talk about...
Well, but and to raise just a little... I cringe when I see those shows sometimes, because when someone says, oh, I found this in my grandmother's attic, I always wonder how many IRS or Pennsylvania Department of Revenue agents are listening in and going and running and checking a tax return when they hear that what looks like a piece of junk is worth $100,000, you know. And there are cases actually where people have gotten themselves in trouble. And the second issue, when someone says, oh, I found this, you know, in my grandmother's attic, what about the other 10 kids who you know, hear on national television that a particular piece is worth $100,000, and, well, they didn't get it as part of their share of the estate, so they can get a little annoyed when that type of thing happens.
Well, we're going to talk about what you need to do while you're alive to avoid those kinds of situations. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. You're welcome to give us a call if you have questions. 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We have in the studio with us this evening attorney Eric Strauss of Wirth, McGee and Fisher, and we are talking about estate planning ideas around your personal property, making sure you have taken measures to document what you have, understand the importance of the value, and what we can do during lifetime to make it easier when we pass on and an executor has to step in and rally up all of this stuff that we've had. So we were just talking about understanding sometimes the value and being very careful to make sure we know what it was. So Eric, two sides of this. One, I want to go, what during lifetime can family members do to communicate to maybe that person who's going to be our executor? What can they do to kind of communicate the value, or should they get appraisals during their lifetime? What about insurance? What can we do during our lifetime to kind of let our kids, yes, this isn't just a bunch of junk, it might have value, and you better pay attention in case something happens to me.
Well, we talked about documentation, and that's always important. Some other things that people should be thinking about is really having conversations with their families or loved ones. You know, if I have a bunch of antique toys and I have a relative, a son, daughter that's very interested in my collection, shares my passion for my collection, I may think of a specific either gift of that collection to that person or some type of a bequest through my will, and we can talk about ways to do that. If I talk to my family and they say, Dad, that stuff you collect is really neat, but we have no interest in it at all, we would sell it. Well, you know, that disappoints a lot of collectors, but it also would key you into planning for their future disposition by sale or perhaps even a charitable gift.
Maybe while you're alive, you mean?
Correct, yeah. Correct, which many people do. And that, I don't know how much time we're going to have to talk about that tonight. That can be a very complex area of the law when we're talking about charitable gifts of tangible personal property to charitable organizations, but certainly it can have some definite tax benefits for people who donate things like that. Another thing that we can do, even if my children aren't interested in my collection, if I'm a collector, I probably know what the best markets for sale are. So I may have friends who collect. I may know the auctioneers who specialize in the type of collection, in liquidating the type of collection I have. I may know galleries, depending on what type of it's a work of art. I may know galleries that specialize in pieces of art of the type that I collect. And that information often only exists in the mind of the collector. And if it's not preserved, it can leave their family really at a loss as to what to do with what appears to be a pile, in some instances, a pile of stuff. I mean, I have an estate right now that a gentleman passed away. His daughter, you know, actually a college professor, so a very well-educated person, came to my office to, we were probating the will, and her first question was, you know, the basement is filled with all this junk. And I said, well, what kind of junk? Mm-hmm. Oh, magazines, this, you know, little action figures. And I said, well, what kind of, oh, these are comic books. I don't know why my dad, you know. Well, I said, we better have someone take a look at it. And we got some, you know, the internet's a great source of information. We found some specialty auctioneers and appraisers. And
that may be different people as well, right? You might have someone who might specialize in comic books and someone who might specialize in antique cars.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so far, we've sold about $300,000 worth of comic books.
Ooh.
In that estate. So I think the old Playboy magazines, am I allowed to say that?
Sure.
The old Playboy magazines.
We're liberal here.
I think were, you know, brought in $3,000. Mm-hmm. And that literally could have all ended up in a dumpster because, it, you know, and that's a perfect example. I mean, this, the fellow who passed away had spent literally his lifetime collecting, preserving a valuable collection of comic books and other, you know, memorabilia of that type, but he had not shared that information with his children. They didn't know much about it. To them, it looked literally like a pile of junk.
Mm-hmm.
I have another estate now where very similar situation, but it involved a bunch of antique fishing lures that the fellow who died, his sister was literally, she said, well, you know, one of his buddies said he'd give me $500 for it. Well, so far, it's been more like $30,000. So, you know, those are two great examples, unfortunate examples. Well, I guess at the end of the day, things came out because they talked to me. But you know, a lot of people don't even think of asking those questions, and these valuable items end up in the dumpster.
And there are probably items as well that may have had value at one time that may not be as valuable over time for whatever reason. I had a friend who had some kind of ceramic figurines that were very valuable in the past, and he said he's just not finding a market for it anymore, and I don't know what they're going to end up doing.
That's a really good point. I mean, everyone, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people talk about their valuable antiques, and particularly pieces of furniture. The market for that type of, I mean, unless it's an original Chippendale from the 1700s in meticulously, you know, preserved condition, it probably isn't worth much. People don't want the giant dining room tables and break fronts and desks and post beds, you know, again, what they call brown furniture, the market's very limited. Mm. And those markets fluctuate with time. Right now, China is buying up a lot of items that were expatriated, you know, years ago. So, you know, there are different periods of time where, you know, countries will, collectors in certain countries will try to repatriate items that were jade pieces, vases, Ming Dynasty pieces. They say art follows money. So where a particular country has a thriving economy, collectors in that country may go seeking out on an international basis collectible items that and try to bring them home.
Now, would an auctioneer have an idea that, like, that this particular pieces that you might have might need an additional appraiser or
Absolutely.
A specialist? Someone could come in and hopefully you can rely on certain professionals.
Yeah, and you have to be careful. I mean, there are a lot of great auctioneers in this area. You have to be careful when you have collections of value because some of the bigger auction houses have resources that some of our local auctioneers just don't have. So if you come upon items that have, you know, a great deal of value, and I'm talking about, you know, pieces that are worth $20,000, $30,000, $100,000. That's not something that you're going to just put an ad in the new local paper and have an auction. You know, you're going to want to put that in the hands of a, you know, an experienced auctioneer that's going to market it, expose it to sale, typically on an international market. They may time the sale very carefully. If I have, you know, 10 collectible pieces, let's say they're antique toy cars, okay, there's only so many people that are going to go to a particular auction on a particular day and buy those items. Mm-hmm. So a very seasoned auctioneer may space them out. They may sell one car at one auction and then let the market heat up again and again, time the sale more carefully, which is a decision in the context of an executor that, you know, you have to really think through. Do you want to convert everything to cash right away? Maybe get a little less value, but at least you're moving your estate administration forward. Or do you want to take your time? But you know, very clearly, the appraisal process and the sale process are two different things. And really, an appraiser should not be involved in the sale. Certainly not the time they're doing the appraisal, because it really can create a conflict of interest.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
Insurance is always too expensive.
And we are back. I'm chatting with Eric on the side here. Thanks, Jeff. Eric and I love estates, so we like talking about them. Folks, if you have questions, this is a great time to call. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We can take questions live on air or off air. You can give your question to Judy Ann. She can write it down and bring it into the studio. So live on air or off air. And as we move through the show, we'll get toward the end talking about what will happen, you know, upon passing. But we're talking now about some things that you can do while you're alive to secure the value of your property so that your heirs will understand or your executor will understand. And that will help in the decision making as to whether you need to do something while you're alive. Maybe it would be better for you to sell it or to donate it. Eric, we've talked about the value of some of these collections, and I know I will often see where people will have personal property like jewelry insured. I know my husband and I, well, I can't wear my rings now because I had surgery, can't get the rings back on, but normally we would insure rings and things like that. You get an appraisal, and people think of insuring that. Do people... So you could talk for a moment about jewelry. Let's talk about artwork or these comic book collections.
Absolutely.
That can all be insured?
Absolutely. And I think the more important point is that items like that are generally not covered under a standard homeowner's policy. So
you have to get riders on it,
correct,
pay it a little extra.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And any insurer is going to want some of the documentation that we already discussed. They're going to want pictures. They're going to want appraisals. They're going to want the history of the piece, because that's how they establish the amount of premium. They want to know what these items are worth. And it's not a bad idea periodically, if you insure collections or artwork, to have it reappraised to make sure it's appraised at what its value is.
Yeah, to my point earlier, where there was a collection that had gone down quite a bit in value.
Correct, because markets change. I think another quick point, I mean, I have a client that probably has, you know, $200,000 of toys displayed in his house, hanging from beams and on shelves. None of them are insured. He just doesn't want to pay for insurance premiums. That's a risk he's willing to take. It's a, you know, as the owner, he has the luxury of, you know, taking that risk. If he dies, his executor probably doesn't have that same luxury, because his executor is a fiduciary who is charged with a duty of protecting his assets, converting them to cash, unless there's some type of a specific disposition, and making sure that the executor obtains maximum value. And if a collection is stolen or destroyed under what should be the watchful eye of an executor, the executor faces possible liability. So, where there is sufficient cash in an estate to insure a collection between the time of the person's death and the time of sale or other disposition, that's something an executor should absolutely be looking at.
Well, you mentioned it could be lost or stolen, and you want that insurance for that. Quite often you might hear about people saying, well, I know Daddy had ABC, or I know Mom had this and that, and my no good brother or sister must have come in and taken it. So if the family has tried to do their, or the owner has tried to do well by making a list, documenting it, maybe insuring their valuables, and they're listed on an insurance policy, and now the executor takes over and says, wait, where did this stuff go? What happened to it? How can we help the survivors in that scenario as well?
Well, it can be tricky, because if things disappear, it can be difficult or frankly impossible to figure out who took it.
Because you might even put in the will. Like, you might have someone come to you and say, hey, Eric, I want this lamp to go to my daughter. And so then you're the attorney working on the estate. You might say, where's the lamp?
Right.
And if no one can find the lamp, what happens?
Well, if no one can find it and it's, you can prove when it was last seen and there's some evidence of theft, or, you know, you can apply for your insurance coverage. If it's a very valuable item, those things don't tend to walk off as much. You know, if something like a lamp, sometimes things like that walk away. And frankly, our court system, it's like when people that are going through a difficult divorce case are fighting over who gets the sofa. And our courts just aren't equipped to really deal with those types of disputes. So, I mean, thus the importance of documenting of an executor. You know, as soon as they're at the time of a person's death, you know, making sure that the house is secure. I mean, something that basic. How many people give spare keys to neighbors and friends? If necessary, getting valuable items out of the house into a separate secure storage facility until you have time to appraise it. We've all heard stories of, you know, while 99% of the family's at the funeral, that 1% is pillaging the house.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at that point, really no executor's even been appointed yet. But you can still act as what we call an executor designateur, which is, you know, you're named in the will, you haven't been formally appointed yet, and if you're acting in good faith, you can take steps to secure and preserve items, particularly of personal property.
Jeff just had a question, and let me give the number again, 610-758-8810, and these are great questions. After an owner of a collection dies, and let's say they had insurance on their collection, is that transferable to the executor or to the new owner? If the new owner, would there be insurance coverage until it's transferred?
It depends on the policy. The important thing to note is that you want to immediately determine if there is insurance. If there is, you want to contact that carrier and find out how long that policy remains in effect. Same thing with a homeowner's policy. I mean, a little bit off topic, but a lot of people are surprised when I tell them that, when a home is vacant, it's typically not covered under the existing homeowner's policy, because now it's a vacant dwelling, whole different insurance risk. So just with the house itself, you want to make sure that it is insured as a vacant dwelling. Some insurers don't insure vacant dwellings. The ones that do, the premium tends to double. Mm-hmm. So insurance coverage is a big issue.
So that would be important, too. If you know you've asked someone to be your executor, it's probably a good idea to make sure they know where your important documents are.
Absolutely.
Kind of let them know, yes, I have this insured or not, and where they're going to find those insurance policies so they know who to contact. Jeff also had asked, how often should items be appraised, do you think?
There's no rule. It really depends on what the market is for that type of item. If it's a very volatile market, obviously you'd want to have it appraised more frequently. Appraisal can cost money. To have a full appraisal of a very valuable piece of artwork can be several thousand dollars. So it's not something that you just willy-nilly. But if it's a million-dollar painting, you know, spending a few thousand dollars on an appraisal is a relatively small expense. And frankly, most people that have million-dollar paintings hanging on the wall can afford that type of appraisal and the insurance that you would need to protect an item like that.
Okay, we're at our halfway mark. And folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can ask questions live on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable with. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
And you are listening to WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 44 degrees with light rain, fog, and mist. Tonight, heavy rain expected with breezy conditions, lows around 48. Thursday, cloudy with a chance of snow showers, highs around 50. And Thursday night, slight chance of snow showers again with lows around 29. The time is now 6:32. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. I have with me this evening attorney Eric Strauss of Wirth, McGee and Fisher. And we're talking about estate planning for your personal property. I find it fascinating. So if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can ask questions off air or on air, whatever you're more comfortable. Judianna, write down the question and bring it in to us. Eric, so we've talked about where people might dispose of property. Someone might dispose of certain collections or personal property, artwork, whatever, during lifetime. And hopefully, if they have had a list or if they had identified those particular items in the will and had decided to sell them, they certainly should update their will or let the attorney know this was sold just so they have it in their records or update that checklist. And then, of course, we would expect to see it on the income tax return as sold as well. And their basis would be whatever they paid for it. Some people get confused about that. What happens when someone passes on and they've had these kinds of collections?
Well, and this sort of ties into what we were talking about a moment ago, when sometimes a person passes away and things just disappear. And I think sometimes, it's actually referred to as empty hook estate planning, that someone dies and there's an empty hook on the wall where the painting used to hang. And I think sometimes people are misguided into thinking if you hide assets like that, that you're saving tax. Frequently, it's the opposite. Right now, Pennsylvania has an inheritance tax that there's no exemption. So if you die and your expenses are paid and bills are paid and there's $1 left, Pennsylvania is going to want a little piece of that. For most heirs, so any lineal descendant, whether it's a child, grandchild, etc., the rate of tax is 4.5%. No one likes to pay that tax, but it's one of the cheapest taxes I know of. Now, if we're in a federally taxable estate, which right now is over $5.45 million, then we're subject to the federal estate tax, which is a much more expensive, it's a 40% tax. But that is not a tax that, I mean, that's the one percenters, right? So most heirs, we're dealing with a 4.5% inheritance tax rate. And to try to hide assets, collectible items, to get out of paying that tax often leads to a bigger tax trap. And here's what the trap is. You mentioned cost basis. So if I buy a painting for $100 and during my lifetime it appreciates to $1,000 in value, I have a $900 capital gain that I'm sitting on. When I sell that item, the rate of capital gains tax on tangible personal property is 28%. That's higher than the rate that typically applies if you would sell shares of stock. One of the nice things about inheriting appreciated property is that when I inherit an item, I get a brand new cost basis, and that's the date of death value. So if I, that painting that I paid $100 for, and now it's worth $1,000, if I give that to you during my lifetime, Lori, you have a $1,000 painting with a $100 cost basis. So things that are gifted during lifetime, the basis changes hands with the, is transferred to the what we call the donee, the person who receives the item. If you sell it, you're gonna pay a whopping capital gains tax. If I give that same item to you under my will, and let's say you're my daughter, humor me for a moment, you're gonna pay a 4.5% inheritance tax. But if you later sell the item, your capital gains tax, so if you sell it for $1,000, your capital gains tax is zero, because you get a new cost basis of date-of-death value. So actually, instead of ripping the painting off the wall and pretending it didn't exist, and try, you know, it's better to come clean. It's better to get that appraisal, pay a couple dollars of Pennsylvania inheritance tax, and get a whole new cost basis that then frees up options for whoever inherited the asset. Mm-hmm. And also helps you document what your basis is. So it's sometimes what things that seem like they're going to save a couple dollars of tax end up creating problems.
And something similar could kind of help happen with even the gifting. If you're someone who expects to be in a federal estate tax situation and you want to gift a valuable collection, maybe to a grandchild, you think you're going to live another 20 years, you want to remove the appreciation. So you still would be transferring at your own basis, but you might be getting the appreciation out of the estate. But again, that would require a filing of a gift tax return where all of that is documented and that transfer is documented.
Yeah, and you would want to establish, I mean, on a gift tax return, if an item is worth, and just so we know what the gift tax is, I mean, right now we have a $5.45 million estate and gift tax exemption. You can, and we have a $14,000 per year annual exclusion. So I can give as many people as I can count $14,000 a year, and it's a tax neutral event. No one pays income tax, no one gets a deduction, okay? The way the estate and gift tax works is if I give someone more than $14,000 a year, I'm supposed to file a gift tax return, where typically I'm not paying tax. What I'm doing is I'm reporting that during my lifetime, I'm using up some of my $5.4 million exemption. Now, if I'm giving $14,000 or $114,000 of cash, let's say, that's easy because I get a $14,000 annual exclusion and the gift of $100,000 is reported on the gift tax return. If I'm giving you a painting that is of uncertain value, I mean, so a gift tax return, you want to document value. You want to get an appraisal, and the IRS requires that you get those appraisals. If it's an item worth more than $3,000, there are requirements on a gift tax return that you attach appraisals. There are requirements for who is a qualified appraiser. And that's something that you absolutely want to do.
Okay, Eric, we had a caller call in off air. They're on Route 78. Albert, thank you for calling and thank you for listening in. Albert's question was, he has relatives who live in Florida. If he were to inherit something from them, residing in Florida, would he be taxed in Pennsylvania where he resides? And Albert, just so you know, this is a question people have often.
Florida, and I'm only licensed to practice here in Pennsylvania, so I'm not licensed to practice in Florida. I happen to know that Florida does not have a death tax. So the taxation of a person's estate is governed by where they are domiciled at the time of their death. The domicile is where you live with the intent of remaining. So if your loved one clearly lives in Florida, the general rule is that the law of Florida governs taxation of their estate. However, lawyers love exceptions. If your loved one has real estate in Pennsylvania, or guess what, tangible personal property in Pennsylvania, that is subject to Pennsylvania inheritance tax. So if your loved one has a vacation home in the Poconos and there's $1 million painting hanging on the wall, the home and the painting are subject to Pennsylvania inheritance tax.
And then you'd have to look at the documents, work with the estate attorneys to know who's going to be liable for those inheritance taxes, because the will may direct that it comes out of the estate, or it may direct that the heirs pay the inheritance tax. So you'd want to just make sure that was clear. The other thing I want to mention, Albert, too, is sometimes when people say, oh, we already paid the inheritance tax, I don't owe any more tax, what they might still owe might be income tax, depending on what they have inherited. So in the examples Eric was giving, for example, for a $1,000 painting, if that got a step-up basis to $1,000 and now you sell it for $1,200, you would have to personally report the $1,200 sale and the $200 gain. And so you might have income tax on that. And the other piece of the other assets that people quite often mix up what they're responsible for are even things like IRAs and retirement accounts that they inherit. They think, oh, the attorney took care of that, the executor took care of that, they already paid tax on it. No, that's typically the executor's responsibility to pay inheritance tax or have the inheritance tax paid through the estate. They're not paying the income tax necessarily. So you want to be careful and make sure that you know what you're inheriting and what your responsibility is. So if you, for example, become the beneficiary of an IRA and you're taking the distributions, you're the one who will have the income tax transaction reporting, etc. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. Thank you, Albert, for calling. Folks, if you do have questions, we still have plenty of time. Phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Eric, what about people who have lots and lots of stuff, personal property? I have seen where people will have three pages of giving, you know, little possessions. And we know that sometimes those little possessions aren't even there maybe 20 years later when the will was written 20 years before because they haven't updated it. Are there some techniques that they can use, perhaps? I've heard of something called a memorandum.
Yeah, there are. There are actually various ways. And I think part of how people approach this issue in their estate plan is driven by what kind of items we're talking about. I mean, if I really discourage clients from cluttering their will with, you know, a bunch of little items. Now, if they have a Monet hanging on the wall, or they have, you know, an item of extreme value that they want to make sure it goes to a specific person or perhaps charitable institution, that is probably best done in a will. There are things called memoranda that people use, and where the will contains a general sort of clause that says, I may leave a memorandum with my personal papers, and I direct my executor to find that memorandum and give the stuff to whoever's named in it. That memorandum under Pennsylvania law is technically not binding. So if the executor finds it and honors it, great. If not, or if the executor finds it and doesn't like what it says and tears it up, well, then it's gone. a safer way, I think, to go about it. So if there are items, you know, a collection of items that has value, maybe not the 50, you know, the million-dollar painting, but things that are valuable, things that are worth, in my opinion, you know, $3,000-$5,000 that you really want to make sure go to specific people, I think the cleanest way to do that is with a codicil. A codicil is a document that is separate from a will. It's executed with the same formality as a will, but that way, you know, if you change your mind, you know, I'm mad at this grandchild, I don't want them to get the painting anymore, I like this grandchild better, you don't have to redo your whole will. You can just redo your codicil, and the codicil is binding and it's enforceable. So it tends to be a good, you know, sort of a practical compromise in terms of how to address items of value. Now, if you know, many people don't have valuable collections or antiques, and I always still suggest that the will contains some kind of clause for disposing of personal property. It can be done by lottery, it can be done by agreement subject to approval by the executor. Some people say, I direct it all be sold, and if my heirs want to go to the auction and bid on it, they can bid on it with the general public. I think most people I talk to, we come up with a clause that says something like this. You know, when I die, my executor, and this is where there's no items of extreme or particular value, a clause that says something like this. I direct my executor to make two piles. The first pile is the stuff that after you talk to the kids really doesn't have any value. No one wants it. That pile you can donate, you can put it in a dumpster, or you can sell it. If you sell it, the money goes into the pot, okay? It becomes part of what we call the residue of the estate. And then there's the other pile. The other pile is the stuff that the kids express some interest in, and the executor sort of supervises division by agreement. And I always put in a time period, you know, that if the people, if the heirs can't agree within 60 days, 90 days, then it'll all be sold. And I think that's important. People often express concern that their children are going to fight over those types of items, and sometimes that happens. In my experience, it's actually children that get along the best that sometimes struggle dealing with the disposition of the personal property because things become overly diplomatic. You know, well, I really like this lamp, so if you want it, you can have it, but if you don't like it, I'd really, well, how many items do we have in a household? And, you know, an overriding concern in any estate is typically getting a home sold. I mean, an empty home in an estate is a liability. And if it becomes a museum filled with a bunch of old furniture and paintings, you know, things that are of relatively small value, all you're doing is you're paying more real estate tax, more insurance, more upkeep and maintenance of a home while the kids are figuring out who gets the lamp and who gets the chair and who gets the... So you want to have some kind of a time period built into the will that the executor can say, look, guys, we have 60 days to do this.
I'm getting the lamp, by the way. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to finish up. If you have questions, 610-758-8810.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have with me in the studio attorney Eric Strauss from Wirth, McGee & Fisher. We're talking about estate planning for your personal possessions. It's a great show. If you ever have, you know, topics that you're interested in learning more about, you can always go visit the WDIY.org website or yourfinancialchoices.com and look for podcasts on various topics relating to your financial choices, of course. And if you have friends who might be interested in this topic tonight, you can always let them know where to go to hear more about it. I made a joke that I'm getting the lamp because I gave my mother a lamp when I was a young girl. I had my own money working, got my mother this hurricane lamp that I'm sure no one in the world would want today, but my mother reads by it every night. My mother's 85 years old, and I told my mom, when you don't need it anymore, I want it to come back to me. So
make sure it shows up on the tax return.
Yeah, I think she's made a note of it. You know, Eric, you talked about, you know, sometimes the family members are so diplomatic and you have to kind of come up with a way sometimes to divvy up the personal property if in the will it kind of says just, you know, give all the personal property to my kids. I would think, are there issues about things like photo albums or, you know, some of that personal, when we talk about tangible personal property and things, things might not be as important to us as tokens of this kind of meaning, like this lamp has meaning to me, photo albums might have meaning. I guess the executor has to decide on that then, right?
Yeah, and when in doubt, an executor always has the power to say, look, I'm going to sell it, it's going to be in an auction, you can show up and bid with everyone else. Issues, and I think an important quality that we should all think about when we choose our executors, who's going to be the diplomat, who's going to be the leader that people are going to just listen to? Actually, those issues are very rare in estates. I mean, usually those things are worked out among family. They don't, you know, they don't turn into legal disputes. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they do. You know, usually when personal property issues become a problem in an estate, it's not the real issue. It's something that happened in the sandbox 30 years ago that there's just some vengeance that you know, people. It is not cost effective if we're talking about ordinary household items.
Right,
it's not
right.
Cost
I agree.
Effective for everyone to hire lawyers and fight.
Yeah, I told Mom, you know, you put notes on it. We have a caller online too. We have Joseph. Joseph, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hi, how can we help you?
I'm thinking I would likely get married to this lovely lady in the next few years. I have some whole term life insurance, and she has some of hers, and I. If I understand correctly, if you are married and you're taking out a policy, you must list the spouse as the beneficiary unless there's some kind of permission. But is this true for policies that are already there? In other words, right now, my policy, the beneficiary is just my estate.
Well, okay, so a couple issues.
And we have a couple other callers, too. So.
Yeah, I mean, number one, I would never recommend, lawyers hardly ever say never, but I would say I would never recommend you have your estate listed as the beneficiary of a life insurance policy.
Yeah,
so some people do that thinking that, well, I have my will and that money will funnel into my will. The problem is that life insurance, as long as it goes to a named beneficiary, is not subject to your creditor's claims. If a life insurance policy is paid into your estate, let's say you die in a car accident and you kill five people and they all sue your estate and the liability is more than your automobile insurer provides. You know, you're now taking this life insurance policy, death benefit, that could have gone free from any creditor's claims to a named beneficiary. You're pouring that into your estate and it's up for grabs. So that tends not to be a good solution. Now, in terms of who is the named beneficiary, there's no law that requires that you have your spouse named as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy ever.
Mm-hmm.
With a qualified plan of the 401k under federal law called ERISA, Employees Retirement Income Security Act, there are requirements that you designate a spouse and can only not designate your spouse if there's a written waiver signed.
Okay. Joseph, I hope that helps. Thank you for calling. We have Carolyn on line one. Carolyn, can you hear us? Hi.
Hi. Yes, I can.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm a little confused. I have a diamond ring that I inherited. It was my mom's engagement ring, and I want my niece to have it. Now, she has, she's recently out of college. She's got a lot of student debt. Is she going to have to pay some kind of tax if she gets this ring?
Are you talking about giving it to her in your will or just giving it to her while you're alive?
In my will. She lives in Maine. I don't know if that matters.
Now, if you live in Pennsylvania and your will says, I give my diamond ring to my whoever it is.
My niece.
That's part of your estate. Right. And actually, nieces pay inheritance tax at a higher rate than children do. Nieces pay inheritance tax, nieces and nephews, at 15%. So something like that, and particularly if it's not an item that she would ever sell, may lend itself to giving it to her while you're alive, which there wouldn't be any tax.
Yeah, so the inheritance tax would come in when you pass, but there's no income tax unless she were to, like, sell it.
Okay.
And if she were to sell it after you died, it gets a step up in basis to whatever it was at date of death. But if there's an inheritance tax and your will says the inheritance tax comes out of the residue of my estate, your niece isn't personally going to be responsible for that inheritance tax. Your executor will take care of that through the filing of the inheritance tax return and the administration of the estate.
Okay, terrific. Okay? Thank you so much.
All right,
much.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
We had a couple other calls or questions that came in off air. We'll see if we can fit these in at the last minute. All the calls at the end here. Thank you for calling, though, everybody. I appreciate it. Isadora called off air, and she said, there's two executors. I assume it's for her mother and father. Two executors, her and her brother, and her brother lives out of state. He keeps trying to have her removed as an executor. Is there something she can do to stop him and perhaps try to remove him? He doesn't visit and never was a part of caring for her parents. What are her rights?
Is this an estate? Well, I guess
yeah, she's off air.
Is the estate currently? I don't know if the estate's currently under administration or if this is just something that their parents' will says.
I'm thinking it might be that their parents are still alive. Let's take that route real quick and then say, what if they're gone?
Well, if the parents are still alive, it's up to the parents who they name as an executor in their will. If it's an estate that's under administration and there are two executors appointed, until a judge throws one of them out, they're both have legal authority to act as executors. It's a point that people need to think about when they name an executor or executors in their will. I've seen estates that get horrifically complicated by having multiple executors who don't get along. A lot of people think, naming an executor is not a popularity contest. It's not who you love the most. It's an executive decision that you're choosing a person that's going to perform an important job responsibly, honestly, with a lot of integrity, and picking two people hoping that they're going to get along. I mean, I've even had people who know their children don't get along that said, "Well, my death will bring them together." I find that is typically not the case.
Now, could there be some undue influence here, Eric, if the parents are still alive and the daughter knows she and her brother are named executors in these living parents' documents? Could there be some undue influence there, possibly?
When you say undue influence,
if one's pressuring the parents to take the other person out for some reason?
I mean, a person's will.
Oh, they are. They called back. They said they are passed.
Okay.
So we did have two executors.
Well, so if we have two acting executors and someone's trying to remove, I mean, that's something that only the court has the power to do, and it has to be for cause. So you would, petition the Orphans Court in Pennsylvania, is the branch of the Court of Common Pleas that deals with trust and estate matters, and whether it's a co-executor or an unhappy heir, any party in interest can petition the court to remove an executor, and the court schedules a hearing and hears the case and decides whether they're going to remove someone or not. And frankly, in many of those cases, if it's feuding co-executors, the court will say, "Look, I'm throwing both of you out. I'm not going to pick, I'm not, without judging either one of you, in the interest of protecting and preserving the estate assets for the benefit of the beneficiaries, I'm going to appoint a neutral administrator. I'm going to appoint a local lawyer, and that lawyer will be paid to administer the estate because you two can't get along."
Okay, great. And Isadora had a follow-up question as well, which is different, but she said her fiancé just gave the nephew a huge cash infusion, a loan. She suggested putting something in his will that he's already been bestowed this money, the nephew, since the nephew expects the inheritance. So her fiancé has a nephew, must not have any other relatives, and everything's going to go to the nephew or some number of people. And we only have a minute, Eric. So when someone does this kind of thing during lifetime, a loan, and maybe their will says 50% to my nephew, 50% to my niece when I'm gone. I'm just giving an example because we don't have time to have all the details of this question. And I've made a loan to one of them. It makes sense to go see the attorney if you want it not to be equal,
right,
because of the loan.
Well, and the question, is it a gift or is it a loan? I mean, if it's a loan, it should be repaid. I mean, a will can forgive that debt. If it's supposed to be a gift and it's documented as a gift, then it's a gift, and it wouldn't automatically alter the dispositive scheme that's set forth in the will.
And if it's a loan, it should be documented that it's a loan, and there would be paperwork and payment schedules and things like that.
Correct.
Awesome. Eric, you were great tonight, and the listeners and the calls, great. Thank you very much for calling in. We love shows where there's questions. Eric, you have about a minute. Any last comments, and then how do people reach you?
Last comments, I don't know. One little funny story, not so funny. We didn't talk much about the IRS and how they look at these things, but any piece of art or collectible that is listed on a federal estate tax return or gift tax return that's valued over $50,000 gets sent to the IRS Art Advisory Panel. It's a group of academicians and collectors that meet periodically. And we're talking big numbers. I mean, the millions of dollars worth of art goes through their review every year. There was a famous art collector, Ileana Sonnabend, that died in California, leaving an $876 million estate. One of them was this three-dimensional artwork with a stuffed bald eagle that her executor valued at zero. The IRS valued it at $27 million and assessed $11 million of tax and penalties. The estate took the position because it had a stuffed bald eagle. You can't, it's contraband. And I'm getting the
well,
hook here.
Eric, we got a break. So it went at zero, right? They donated it, I think.
Yep, they did.
Thank you so much for being here. Eric, how do people reach you? What's your phone number?
My phone number is 610-437-4896. My office is at 2610 Walbert Avenue in Allentown.
And it's worth McGee and Fischner. Thanks, listeners. Stay tuned for Tom Druckenmiller Within the Tradition. Next week, listeners, income tax questions. I'm going to take your income tax questions next week. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.